It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello, welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show. And today, I am not on Skype like I normally am. I am not in a pub in Manchester with my mates. I'm actually in my own office recording the podcast with one of my best friends, Mr. Simon Heath. How are you, sir?
Hello, James. I'm very, very well indeed. Yeah, live from the studio.
Live from the studio, not apartment, actual studio.
Actual studio.
The actual studio where I work most days of the week.
The famed halls of the Troopany Show.
Yes, exactly. And me and Si have spent more time than enough in this office playing guitars and talking crap. And
it's true, but I haven't been in here for about 6 years.
No.
And you've it's not changed a bit.
No, not at all. Not so much as a lick of paint.
Nope.
But there you go. Because I don't have time for that kind of thing, because I've got wrestling to watch.
Hey!
And today's show is Back to the Beginner's Guide for Japanese Wrestling, which we've kind of like left alone for a while because there's just been so many good wrestling shows on that we have to keep you informed about. And from a variety of different companies, Impact had a good wrestling show. No, they had a competent wrestling show.
You see, this is it. When Impact starts putting on good shows, you know there's too much good wrestling going on.
Yeah, it's just what's going on with the world. And we are actually recording this 24 hours before possibly our favourite wrestling show of the year may happen.
Could be
Wrestle Queendom in Bethnal Green in the York Hall. Yeah, the actual York Hall, the biggest women's wrestling show in Europe in history. And lots of people are very excited about it. And this is going to sound very starry, but I actually was talking to Chris Wolf earlier today, and she is very excited about it.
He started name dropping already.
The amount of people I've been talking to this week. Oh, okay then. So, we're going to look today at, let me get this right, because I have to pronounce it, because it's partly in Korean. The Pyongyang International Sports and Culture Festival for Peace. Yes. Otherwise known by WCW fans as Collision in Korea. Now, we thought this was an appropriate show to do this week because this was Wrestling Diplomacy, as it was called, and as it's named throughout the pay-per-view at intermittent intervals by Mr. Ishikawa, who is the Japanese commentator.
Not to be confused with Cowboy Diplomacy. Slightly similar.
Which is what we've got going on in the moment.
Yes.
So we thought this was appropriate as North Korea and South Korea are going into peace talks to try and end the war that they've been at since the ceasefire in the early 50s. We thought now was a time to brace the biggest wrestling show of all time.
Yes.
Literally the biggest wrestling show of all time. Now, I did talk about this way back at the very beginning of the Troopany Show 4 years ago with Mr. Ben Spindler, and we were talking about the biggest drawing shows of all time. And as me and Ben quite rightly pointed out, is it really the biggest crowd of all time if they were all held there at gunpoint?
I mean, you could argue the same of a lot of the WCW crowds in the late 90s. So.
Yeah, I think really it's still the biggest crowd of all. It just generally is the biggest crowd of all time. And it was an interesting way of going about pro wrestling.
It's certainly the biggest crowd. I'd argue whether it's the loudest, though.
Well, I'm not even convinced there was like genuine soundtrack on there.
No, well, that's possibly true because what we watched is more of a compilation, isn't it?
It was done over 2 days. So let's look at, well, we'll have to break it down history-wise first of all. Let's go back to the beginning of where it all started. And it started with a germ of an idea from the man with the biggest ego in the world, Antonio Inoki. He wanted to pay tribute to his mentor, Ricky Dozan. For those of you who've been listening to the Beginner's Guide all the way from the beginning, he was the first person we talked about. Ricky Dozan was the first major star in Japanese professional wrestling, who was indeed a Korean, not Japanese. And Antonio Inoki thought it was time to pay homage to his great mentor, which is a noble enough feat. Now, Antonio Inoki was also part of the Japanese Diet, which meant the Japanese House of Lords, or the Japanese Senate, and he had a bare bit of political nous. He worked on their Foreign Operations Committee, and he was in the process of trying to start a peace dialogue with North Korea.
Well, he was in the process of being indicted for various
and needed something big to
distract everyone.
Basically. So, where have we heard that tactic from politicians before?
This is it works on so many levels.
Yeah, it does. So Antonio Inoki starts working on this peace process, and what better way to bring two nations who have been at loggerheads for half a century together than show them wrestling?
Yeah, clearly.
Because that's the obvious thing to do.
Yeah. as we're seeing currently with Saudi Arabia and Iran.
This is another reason why this is pertinent. Obviously, we've just had the big greatest Royal Rumble of all, which is some really weird hashtags. Hashtag GRR.
WWE grr.
Grr. It's like, what? Which was an interesting political nightmare, obviously, where we've had the discussion about there being no women on that show. Obviously, certain members of their roster could not go. For instance, Sami Zayn, who's Syrian, who's obviously not going to hang out in Saudi Arabia because he's got more sense. And Kane, Glenn Jacobs, who got the nomination for for the mayor of... What town is he running for?
Knox County.
Knox County.
Confused with Knox County.
Yeah. not to be confused with the ropey third division football team. No. But he's, he didn't want to work in a country that is run on Sharia law, fairly obviously.
Yeah.
Might do his options not so good. And it's actually, to be fair, it's nice that WWE allowed them to work with their conscience and not really have it affect them, you know, because in previous incarnations, that might not have happened so much.
I mean, we say it's not going to affect him, but I think
we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. if we don't see Sammy on TV.
I'm pretty sure Glenn Jacobs is fine.
Yes, he probably is.
Yeah, so, I'll not do anything, then I'll go home. This is another option for him, especially if he actually gets to be mayor of the place he's running in.
That their place.
Kentown, there you go. Cowtown.
Yes.
the old town. There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. sorry, you may have noticed that when me and Si are left to our own devices, things getting to be a bit wayward.
Normally we have somebody.
Yes, normally we have Alex or Chelsea or Marcus to make us go, oi, do the job properly.
Yeah, exactly. When we go on random sojourns about people's haircuts.
Well, we might be meeting Alex Edwards tomorrow. He might calm us down.
I thought you were going to say tonight.
He also used to live in Lincolnshire.
Oh, God.
Yeah, anyway, the Yellow Bellies podcast shall continue.
Yes.
So Antonio Inoki sets up this peace festival over a period of years. It takes a long while for this to happen. But quite remarkably, he pulls it off. And it is an incredibly... It's really... You cannot say how hard this is. This is a ridiculously difficult thing. You know, there was... There was a storyline in The West Wing, in one of the early episodes of The West Wing, where North Korea walked off on a trade deal because the flags were the wrong size at the negotiating table. And that was based in truth. Is that things like that have happened with North Korea. They can just take the ball and go home at any time. So to get into the country, especially from a country like Japan, which doesn't have the best of reputations within Korea, you know, that's one of the reasons why South Korea ain't keen on Japan either at the moment. Or ever have been since the Second World War. So, you know, this is a massive achievement for anyone to pull off. And he only brings in South Koreans and North Koreans together and the Japanese together. He also brings in an American wrestling company to work with New Japan Pro Wrestling and create this massive event. So, Sai, how does he do this?
From the American point of view, how they did it was basically by not telling anyone, from what I gather. Apparently, Eric Bischoff, who had a working relationship with Inoki anyway, supposedly never actually spoke to anybody at Turner.
Right.
He just he asked a hypothetical to a couple of his mates and said, what do you think would happen if I took a load of wrestlers to North Korea and did this show? And they were like, well, you might get a phone call from the State Department, but you probably wouldn't go to jail. And he was like, all right, then, that's fine by me. And he just went. Supposedly, he never actually asked permission from any of the Turner brass. They just decided to go. He just figured they'd get back and see what the consequences were.
Which is fair enough, I guess.
Yeah. The only person he did ask, apparently, was Hogan, because Inoki wanted Hogan.
Yes.
He didn't necessarily want Flair as the big attraction.
Yeah, which you can imagine would be the thing.
Makes more sense, yes. Especially from a Japanese point of view.
Yeah.
And also, he was going to do the evil American...
Yes.
You know, this is your star-spangled banner
Who'd
waving.
You flip? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently Hogan just looked at him as if he'd just asked him to get on a rocket and go to Mars. So he gave up on that pretty quickly. But yeah, that's sort of... when Hogan is the person with the most amount of power in the company that you speak to, And he goes, no.
Yeah, and it is just like Hulk Hogan's going to go, I had enough of that shit before. I'm not dealing with him again.
Yeah, exactly.
And he wouldn't deal with him again for, well, actually, that's not fair. He had been dealing with Antonio Inoki, but didn't actually have to wrestle him.
No.
Which is a different matter. As we discussed in 1993, he had some big profile matches, including selling out the Tokyo Dome 3 times, wrestling Great Muta was one of them, and a couple of others as well. When he was WWF champion, it was the first time the IWGP, NWA, and WWF championships had all been in the same ring at the same time. Non-title match, because it could have caused a whole bunch of problems, but that did happen. So, you know.
I wonder whether one of Hulk's problems was the fact that he would have to work heel.
Yeah.
I mean, this is 95, so this is pre-Bash at the Beach.
Yes, it's pre-Hollywood. This is pre-Hollywood,
yeah,
Hogan.
So I wonder, even so close to that.
Yeah,
that
he hadn't reached that peak of faceness at that particular point.
Well, people hadn't got sick of him quite enough.
Yes. Though there was, well, that's a different podcast. Hulk Hogan in WCW is about 5 podcasts that I can think of, because I was watching it at the time and I could see what was going wrong even in my younger mind. It was like, yep, you're gonna fail. But going back to this show, you can see that the level of politics is really, really high as wrestling politics, not just like international politics, which is the reason why you get a card that's not, well, the card's a political minefield in itself anyway.
Yeah.
When we get to some matches, we will kind of like explain what actually happened with those particular wrestlers and why they were there and shouldn't have been there, really. But the actual card itself wasn't great.
Yeah.
It was all right. I think it was like, I didn't watch the Greatest Royal Rumble of all, but my friends at the Total Wrestling Podcast did a preview of it, and they were saying, like, well, the first match was like, here's how wrestling works.
Yes.
So you could enjoy the rest of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there was a lot of that going on in this. They had to make it simple and easy to understand.
Yeah. Well, from what I understand, the North Korean fans, if they can so be called.
People in the building.
Yes. The North Korean attendees. they expected to have a sort of scientific wrestling showcase. Like they were expert, because they're only... There's no Western culture.
No.
And I know it's stupid to talk about Japanese wrestling as Western culture, but you know what I mean.
There is no wider culture of the Orient.
Indeed.
Yes.
And I mean, that's true now, but it was definitely true back then.
Yeah.
So they had no exposure to pro wrestling at all prior to this, really. I doubt many of them even knew who Ricky Dozan was.
No.
So... I think they were expecting a sort of, presumably they'd had some Olympics, some Olympic wrestling.
That's it.
So that's their only exposure to it. I think they were expecting that, and that is not what they got.
So the first exposure to professional wrestling they get is Too Cold Scorpio, which is the best first exposure to professional wrestling you could possibly have.
Absolutely.
Getting down with his bad self.
Yes.
In the pre... I can't remember the name. Flash Funk. Pre-Flash Funk dance phase of Too Cold Scorpio.
There was only one Flash on this card.
No, there was indeed. The greatest Flash of them all.
Indeed.
Yes, we'll get to him later.
Yes, we will.
And he wrestled Wild Pegasus, Chris Benoit. And to be honest with you, after all this time, I still have a hard time watching Chris Benoit matches.
Yeah, I mean, especially when they end with the diving headbutt.
Yes.
And it's a tough watch, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know,
which is a shame.
Yeah, it is, because this is a perfectly serviceable match. It does what it's supposed to do.
Well, I mean, this is an ECW match.
Yes,
of this era,
because they
isn't
were
it?
Signed to ECW at this time.
I think 4 months earlier, same match occurred on an ECW television show.
Yeah, because this was at the time New Japan talents, and the rule still is to this day: if you are not working for New Japan, you can work for anyone else outside of Japan.
Yes,
and Paul Heyman got on the blower and hired Too Cold Scorpio from New Japan Pro Wrestling because he'd just come out of the New Japan Pro Wrestling dojo where, quote unquote, I was getting my ass kicked every day.
Yes.
Chris Benoit, again, who was just not just graduated, he'd been graduated a while before then, but he was on the main roster for New Japan. Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero were also working New Japan shows at this time, and Paul Heyman picked them all up at a song price, and Chris Jericho followed not long after.
I mean, it could well have been this match or this event that eventually led to Benoit getting signed by WCW, because it was only, it was later this year, I think, that he started wrestling. Maybe not signed, but certainly wrestling regularly for them.
They were signed under duress because they wanted to stay in ECW. It was Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, and Eddie Guerrero. They were signed to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and then WCW said, we want them, and New Japan had to assert their option, which was New Japan tell you where you wrestle, in anywhere else in the world. So they said, we want you to work for WCW, and that's when you had the big tearful send-off match between Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero in ECW.
Yes.
And it was basically, they didn't want to leave, but they couldn't go anywhere. They had to go to WCW.
Right.
So, and it was big fanfare when they signed Benoit. He rolled up in a limousine, and Guerrero and Malenko were big names as well. They were introduced as superstars. So it paid off for them when they were doing it. But going back to this match, it was a very good match. It was exactly what you'd expect for the opening of a card anywhere in the world. It was good, solid, basic wrestling with a bit of flash towards the end.
Yep, and right out of the bat, mullet.
Yeah, mullet.
Straight at first match.
Chris Benoit's mullet was a thing of beauty at that particular time. Kind of feathered.
Yeah, a bit thinning on top.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
But not quite the Hulk Hogan.
No. And, you know, you also forget that thing on top was Too Cold Scorpio's issue at the time as well.
Yeah.
The Widow's Peak there was prominent.
It certainly was.
Yes. He goes shaved-headed these days for that reason.
Well, it's all that high flying, isn't it? It's wind resistance just whipping it.
Oh, dear. And then we had, a singles match. That's best we could say. There was some wrestling.
There was. I saw this match on paper and I thought, oh, Yuji Nagata in his younger days, brilliant. We're going to see some proper Japanese wrestling. And then 4 minutes later,
he won.
Yeah. And I was like, oh.
And it was Yuji Nagata, as you see him today, just wearing black instead of blue.
Yes.
That was the only difference. He does exactly the same things that he did back then. Only slightly slower these days.
Can I also point out that at the start of this match, Mike Tenay went on a huge diatribe about how the two wrestlers in the ring looked exactly the same. And I was just head in hands going, Mike, seriously? You can't do this.
No. Take a step back here, Mike. We should probably talk about the commentary at this time. There was a gentleman called Mr. Ishikawa who worked for New Japan Pro Wrestling, supposedly worked for New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah.
Who was commentating as a heel commentator on the WCW commentary, alongside one of the early performances in WCW of Mike Tenay, who was his usual knowledgeable self, coloured the whole show with actual facts that were worthwhile listening to.
Yeah.
And there was babyface Eric Bischoff, which is no one's favourite commentator.
It was painful. I mean, I know it's difficult, because they were recording the commentary after the fact.
Yeah,
weren't they?
I mean,
it was a compilation show, as you say.
Yeah.
Made out of various matches from the 2 days that they put on over there. But my God, I mean, has anybody ever commentated on paint drying? Because I don't. Because I feel like. I mean, obviously, the old adage is that paint drying is the most boring thing you can possibly watch. But yeah. I feel like if you were actually commentating on, the World Championships of paint drying, you'd have to sort of zhuzh it up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, and get behind it to get people excited in it.
Coming out now with 14 coats of Dulux.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God, he's gone for the mint.
Dave from Stafford with a roller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Bischoff, nothing. Just I feel like he's doing... He's trying to do the Vince McMahon babyface commentator play-by-play thing, but he just doesn't.
He falls between two stools. He's trying to tell interesting stories and commentate on the match.
Yeah,
which essentially the only person who could ever do that was Lance Russell, and he's not Lance Russell. And the reason why I hated Bischoff from the very beginning and still don't get on with him now. Because we fall out on Twitter all the time. Rick.
God's sake.
but the reason why was because the show we used to get on ITV was the NWA Power Hour, or WCW Power Hour as it was, which was a compilation show, which was commentated on by Lance Russell. And then one week, Lance Russell goes, if I get lucky, I'll see you next week. And the following week, it was Eric Bischoff.
Mm.
So you went from literally the greatest commentator of all time to Eric Bischoff.
Yeah, nobody got lucky, really.
No,
did they?
No, they didn't. No, no. So, anywho. But yes, I mean, there was nuggets of information. It was nice listening to Eric talk about how the show got set up, and some of the things he came out with was very interesting.
Yeah.
But the actual commentating on the match was dreadful.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it really was.
So we move on to the third match, which featured the coolest man that ever lived, Masahiro Chono.
Of course.
And Hiro Saito. They defeated, rather. It's kind of like he, because I don't want to downplay what Hiro Saito did, but he was along for the ride.
I mean, this is soon to be not only NWO Japan teammates, but also Team 2000 teammates.
Indeed.
Show a bit of respect.
Yes, exactly. The granduncle of Los Ignorables de Japón.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
Actually, in genuinely, the adopted father of one of my best friends, alpha female Jesse Gabbert. So, you know.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, and just the coolest dude. MVP calls him the coolest wrestler ever lived, and it's true. He was at his full pomp of heelness at mm-hmm. this particular point. This was after he got dropped on his head by Steve Austin and broke his neck and come back as a badass heel because he could no longer work the style he had done before, which is, funnily enough,
exactly what happened to Steve Austin.
Yes. And it was the same move he did it on.
Yeah.
It was a reverse spike pile driver that Steve screwed up, and then Owen did that to him 18 months later.
Conspiracy.
I don't think it... Well, actually, to be honest with you, Owen and Chono were in the New Japan Dojo together, so... no, probably not. I don't think he was. I don't think any of either of them would intentionally hurt anyone.
Did Saito not spend a bit of time in Stampede as well?
Yes, he did, yeah. Well, I think we're laying far too into this match. It was all right. It did what it said on the tin. Samurai and Yasuda were fine. El Samurai is one of those guys who has fantastic matches with the right opponent.
Yeah.
These were not the right opponents for him.
No.
You know, he's a guy that is very talented, and in any other era, he would have been the ace of the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division.
Yeah.
However, he was in the same era as Jushin Thunder Liger, who was his great nemesis, and they had barnstormingly wonderful matches for years on end. But with anyone else, it was just treading water till he got back to Liger.
Yeah, I felt this match was a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
I did sort of, I don't know whether it was just like I'd zoned out, but I wasn't sure who the, because I don't know the history particularly of this time period, so I mean, Master Chono comes out in a Matrix overcoat 4 years before the Matrix was made.
Yeah.
I probably should have realised that was supposed to be a heel move, but I didn't. So I wasn't even sure like who was supposed to be heel or face in this match until about 30 seconds before the end, where Chono, it's almost like he just went, right, I'm done with this now. I have finished with this match now. You may take it away. And he just ball shots someone and just goes full heel, and he's chucking people. And that last 30 seconds of the match was brilliant, I thought. I felt like if you're going to make a compilation sort of highlight package and then commentate over the top of it, just have that last 30 seconds in.
There you go.
I need the rest of it.
That's all you need.
Just ball shot, go home. There you go.
Arguably currently WWE's, there you go.
Yes,
there you go.
Forever shall be known as the Shinsuke Nakamura.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah. Well, the Toru Yano.
Ah, yeah, yes. Well.
This is the
chaos.
Like, the chaos. Shinsuke Nakamura has effectively stolen Toru Yano's stick and taken it to WWE with him.
I mean, he's not stolen all of his stick. I'd love it if he did. that would be totally different AJ Styles Shinsuke Nakamura
awesome,
matches if that happened.
Oh, it'd be fantastic. Anyway, moving on. Match number four on this tape. By the way, you can find this on YouTube. It's perfectly acceptable. I think no one dare put it on their streaming network because I don't think anyone knows who owns the rights to it.
No, I love the little copyright addendum at the bottom of the YouTube video as well. It's like, this is designed for educational purposes only. Like, don't ever do this again.
So yeah, because I'm guessing the network can't put it up because it's all New Japan stuff.
Yeah.
And New Japan can't put it up because they're off the contractors. There's some people who are contracted to WCW and therefore WWE.
Yeah, I mean, New Japan aren't exactly on the ball when it comes to putting archives up on New Japan World anyway, are they?
No, they put up the nice bits, but they don't put the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Quite understandable. They're a bit more...
Well, I mean, WWE put Thunder on, so you can't...
Yeah. They're a bit more discerning, New Japan. They're not going to put stuff up that's a bit naff, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Recent stuff that is a bit naff is fine.
Well,
yeah.
It'd be funny if 1 week this actually wasn't a great show. We won't bother.
Yeah. Oh, well, they did put on Scott Norton versus Dave Sullivan, which was god awful.
Yeah.
The worst match we ever saw. me and Alex decided it was the worst match of all time.
Eve Ad Sullivan.
Yeah, which was around this time period, a couple of years before. Anyway, let's move on. We're going off the point again.
No.
Yes. Match four. Oh, well, really, they should have given up after this match because this is by far the best thing on the show.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, looking at the card, you could pretty much guarantee that this was going to steal the show, couldn't you?
But yeah, Bull Nakano and Akira Hokuto defeated Minami Toyota and Mariki Yoshido, four wrestlers with more talent than the rest of the card put together.
Yes.
Yes, except with the obvious exceptions of the bigger names on this card. They were just... It was basically... You know, if you want to shock and awe an entire nation into giving up communism, I'm giving you Bull Nakano and Akira Hokuto.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good shout.
Look at that. There you go. Yeah. That's your capitalism right there.
You know, you guys love theme parks, right?
Yeah,
check this out.
Look at this. Liberal democracy. There you go.
Yep, absolutely.
And if you don't like them too, look at these two. They can fly like nobody's business. You don't get that flying in communism. There you go. And it was just ridiculously good. After watching the previous three matches, it was just like, oh, I forgot wrestling could be this good.
This is where Eric Bischoff totally lost me. I'd just like to point that out, though.
Right.
Not to detract from the quality of the match, but I always remember the story that Mick Foley tells about when he left WCW because they failed to follow up on his feud with Vader.
Yeah.
And there was a piece of commentary that he talked about when Vader powerbombed him on the bare concrete.
Yeah.
And somebody, I can't even remember who was commentating at the time, but somebody just said, oh, that'll give you Excedrin headache number 9. Or
Bobby Eaton and Tony Schiavone.
There you go. And I was reminded of that during this match when you had this ridiculous sequence that, like, it would not have been out of place in any work rate indie show right now. Just like move after move. Yeah. Topes and top rope suplexes and the whole nine yards. And Eric Bischoff was talking about how I think it was Yoshida is always wrapped up before her matches. It's Hokuto.
Yeah.
Because she's injured all the time. And he just said, I bet Johnson & Johnson's shares have gone up this week.
Yeah.
For God's sake, Eric. Just watch the match.
Yes, yes. Don't make jokes at the talent's expense when you're not funny. Anyway, but yes, Eric, depart from the commentary team. And it is really weird watching classic AJW with an American commentary on it.
It's very weird. Yeah,
it is strange.
Because it's almost like every so often they just stop and somebody would say, "This is really good." And then there'd be a pause again. We know.
Yeah, it's just so astoundingly quick because everything else had been so plodding, except with the Scorpio Benoit match. Everything else had been so plodding.
To be honest with you, even the Scorpio Benoit match for a Scorpio Benoit match was fairly slow paced.
I've
sort of got the feeling to this point that a lot of people were thinking, "Let's not kill ourselves, lads."
Yeah,
none of these people are ever going to see any of our matches ever again. Yeah. So
let's just have a nice safe match, and then these four turn up and suddenly the work rate's got to go through the roof.
Yes,
because they don't care what your booking rules are. They're going to do what they want to.
No,
all four of them. And Yoshida was a rookie at the time, and she would have still like gone at a booking list and gone
she neck bridged out of a Bull Nakano pin.
Yes,
I mean these things shouldn't be possible.
No, she was fantastic. I'm much more familiar with Marika Yoshida from Arsion, because I watched tons of Arsion, and there she was like a mat working shooter.
Mm.
She changed her style completely, which was probably sensible for the longevity of her career.
Yes.
Because she only retired last year.
Right.
Yes. So this show was 1994. She retired last year.
Uh-huh.
24 years later.
Right. 24 years after she took that powerbomb from Bull Nakano.
Yes. Yes, her vertebrae were all in one piece, apparently.
Yes.
And bearing in mind that Minami Toyota only retired last year.
This is true.
Akira Hokuto and Bull Nakano did retire a lot earlier in their careers, but Akira Hokuto was basically held together with sticky tape by the end of her career. So, you know, and Bull Nakano went off and did a bunch of other stuff and, yeah, professional golfer.
Yes, and she looks 20 years younger than she did then as well, which I'm always amazed about.
Yeah, she's quite remarkable. And if you look at her retirement show, she was bigger at her retirement show than she was in her heyday.
Mm.
And now she is like thinner than Manami Toyota was in her heyday.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Moving on, anyway, speaking of good matches, this was very good, and it was of a style at the time that Hashimoto, or Shinya Hashimoto, who's the person in this match, and Scott Norton were kind of developing. It's kind of a dad fight, so I kind of figured you'd like this. Shinya Hashimoto, we've talked about before on the podcast, the destroyer, the big hitter of the Three Musketeers, and this was his time to shine. He was building a reign with the IWGP Heavyweight Championship that is still talked about today, especially as Kazuchi Kurikada is kind of emulating what that reign was about. Mm. And one of the reasons that made that reign so special is because of Scott Norton. And the reason why is because Scott Norton and Shinya Hashimoto could literally kick the living shit out of each other for 20 minutes and just keep going. They were hitting each other so hard, so ridiculously hard, especially in the matches back in Japan. This one was kind of a bit sedate compared to their other stuff, but they were trying to build this new style of a slow burn. Everything starts slowly and builds to a climax. Now, this is only a 20-minute time limit match, and I don't, although it says on the Wikipedia page it was a championship match, I don't think it was, because they didn't hold the title up.
They didn't announce it as that.
No, they didn't, no.
I mean, I suppose they might not necessarily for the American broadcast anyway.
Yeah, so that style is essentially what Kazuchi Kurikada does now. You know, he's notoriously seen as a slow starter, but he's all about build, and he's all about using the opponent's ability to make everybody look good.
Yeah.
Well, Hashimoto did the same thing, but he wasn't kind of like playing his opponent's game. He was doing his own thing. But this was a stunning example of how this works. It's the slow build, take a lot of punishment, and then have a big comeback from the champion. And Scott Norton was an important part in the architect of this particular style as well, because there's few people who could do it and pull it off well, because you have to be so big to take all those big hits. And Scott Flash Norton was absolutely fantastic in this match. This is the kind of thing that Ben Spindler doesn't like, because it's got Scott Norton in it.
What?
What did you think of this match, Si?
I mean, when it first started out, I was really enjoying it. It was very, very slow-paced, as you said, but the psychology was so perfect that I was really drawn into it for about the first 10 minutes. And then I felt like they got a bit lost.
Yeah.
I don't know what... I mean... I do love a dad fight. You know I love a dad fight.
I do. Yes, you do love a dad fight.
20-minute time limit. Draw dad fight? Maybe not so much. But my major problem with this was the ending.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the build-up of the match. But build-up is nothing without payoff.
Climax. Yeah, yeah.
And this match didn't really have one. I mean, you had the little burst of activity just before the time limit.
Mm.
Where they started going back and forth with the big moves.
Yeah.
But then it just ended. For me, a time limit draw, especially one involving a championship, needs to have that moment where somebody nearly wins it. If it wasn't for the fact that it was a time limit draw, they could have had them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I never felt that with this match. I just felt like they would have carried on for another half an hour doing the exact... because, Scott Norton comes off the top rope. And I wondered whether the timing was off slightly with this.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
When Scott Norton came off the top rope, and I was thinking, well, this has been about 20 minutes. And also, another commentary point.
Yeah.
They totally telegraphed the fact that this was going to be a time limit draw
yeah.
by bringing up the fact that there was a 20-minute time limit on the
yeah,
match
yeah.
when they hadn't mentioned that at all in any of the other
no.
matches. He said that about, I think it was Tanay, said that about 3 minutes in. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a time limit draw, isn't it? But yeah, Scott Norton comes off the top with a big splash.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, maybe he's going to get to two, and then the
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know, the time's going to run out, and they're going to go, oh, he could have had him. Maybe he would have had him. But no, Hashimoto kicks out at two, and they pick each other up, and they exchange Irish whips, and then the time ends, and streamers yeah. fall from the ceiling for some reason.
Because every time a drum should end with streamers falling from the ceiling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
You know. So that was I enjoyed the build-up, but I just felt like there was nothing...
I think it would have been better if they'd kind of... They didn't telegraph it, and they kind of telegraphed it too much. But if you'd had the first match or the second match go to a 10-minute time limit draw
yeah.
to show that this could happen,
yeah.
that would have more effect
yeah.
doing it the way they did. But you're right, if they'd gone to a near fall, even if it's just like a couple of seconds after, if Hashimoto kicks out on two and then a couple of seconds later the bell rings.
Yeah, or like Scott Norton's picking him up
yeah.
for another big move
yeah.
and then it ends. And you're like, yeah. oh, if only he'd had a couple more minutes.
Yeah, that's it.
But yeah, there was none of that. It was just kind of, we're going to keep going and, oh no, we've run out of time.
Yeah.
And I felt that detracted from it a little bit. But as you were saying at the start of the show, this match, probably a lot of politics involved in it.
Yes, I would have thought so. And they're trying to keep the pot boiling. This was probably shown on Japanese pay-per-view or television anyway. So they're trying to keep the pot boiling on this feud, and they can't swap the title. Although it makes sense to swap the championship, that would make Hashimoto look weak, but they're trying to build this roller coaster ride. He eventually loses the title. I think he loses the title fight at Fujinami and then destroys Fujinami in the rematch to just pick up where he left off. You know.
Can we have a little Scott Norton addendum on this match, though? I just want to tell you a little story I found
Please do.
About Scott Norton on this particular trip. So Scott Norton phoned his wife while he was on this trip out in North Korea. And she, legend has us believe, accused him of cheating on her while on tour.
Right.
I don't want to say one way or another whether he was or not. History has not recorded these facts, but he was accused. And this made Scott Norton very, very mad. So he started arguing with his wife down the phone. And in the midst of this angry tirade, he called North Korea a shithole. And at the moment of him calling North Korea a shithole, the phone went dead. Because his phone call was being monitored by the North Korean authorities, as presumably everybody's phone calls were on this particular tour. So a few hours later, the men from the ministry came down and marched him away to a state police station and interrogated him for a couple of hours over this phone call that he'd had with his wife. While on this tour, they eventually let him go, but they were worried that they weren't going to let him back to America.
Wow, that is intense, isn't it? This is the kind of level you're playing with things we're playing with here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's really like we said, it's how did this happen? You know, it's the will of Antonio Inoki over everything else, which just proves that the man was he had an ego that could actually stop wars.
Yeah.
Literally.
And that was only one of four people on this card, I think, that they were worried about not being able to return to to their country of origin.
Yeah.
So I think Scorpio and Hawk, I think, got into a fist fight on a bus.
Unsurprising.
Yep. And Flair refused to cut a promo at the end of the show. Basically ripping on America.
Right.
So he just thanked the dear leader and the people of North Korea. And that was all he did. But because they'd scripted him this promo where he would go up and spit on the American flag or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And he refused to do it. And they were worried that they weren't going to let him come back either. So, we laugh about it now.
No, but this is serious stuff. This is this is international incident stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
They were playing with serious fire at this particular point.
And I mean, considering that Eric Bischoff didn't ask anybody at Turner whether they could go or not, imagine if he'd lost Ric Flair. He'd come back and Ric Flair's in a North
hokey.
Korean. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, being brainwashed. And if you look, I've actually watched there is an All Japan video. All Japan Women did a video following Akira Hokuto. They did a documentary on Akira Hokuto, and they followed her on this tour, and it is noticeable all the New Japan guys are in their Zubas with their vest tops and their bum bags,
and
then Manami Toyota and Akira Hokuto get out of the limousine and they're wearing their All Japan Women blazers with nice blouses and straight black pencil skirts and heels, looking the part and being ultra professional. And then you've got Scott Norton there posing in front of statues of the dear leader, and he's just like, oh god, they really didn't talk to you enough, did they? Could you find a suit? Good lord.
I'd imagine if you're Scott Norton, it's probably quite difficult to find a suit.
Yeah, fair enough. And Scott probably wouldn't care anyway. You'd tear the sleeves out. Okay, then. But that was it probably wasn't an IWGP Heavyweight Championship match because it was a draw. The next one was Road Warrior Hawk, which was on the second... I believe that was the main event of the first day. They edited out the matches down on the second day. The second day had Road Warrior Hawk versus Tadayu Yasuda, who drew the unfortunate short straw of wrestling Road Warrior Hawk.
I mean, earlier on in this show, Bischoff had said that they cobbled together matches from two nights, and they said, so if you see a wrestler twice, that's why. Why was it Yasuda that we had to see twice of all the wrestlers on this card?
The boring one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The guy who had only been wrestling for like a week and a half or something.
And that's to kick off with Hawk.
Yeah.
Yeah, who was in his usual forgiving mood as by the looks of things. Actually, he wasn't particularly working very stiff with him, but he was.
No, he wasn't. He was being quite gentle and even selling a little bit as well.
Yes, which is unusual. Hawk was getting softer in his old age at this point. This is the point just after, well, it was after SummerSlam 92, so Hawk and Animal weren't on speaking terms.
Hmm.
This was supposed to be the reunion of the Road Warriors, but I'm not completely convinced it was. They would reunify in WCW in a couple of months' time. So they were back on talking terms at this particular point. But it was towards the tail end of Hawk's kind of forgettable solo run. He did have a fantastic tag team with Kensuke Sasaki, the Hell Warriors. The Hell Raisers, I apologize. I will get the team names right in a second, I'll explain. But he was part of the Hell Raisers tag team with Kensuke Sasaki, who had a fantastic run with the Jurassic Powers and the Steiner Brothers in 93. But this was a forgettable period for Hawk, really.
Yeah, this led to another great Eric Bischoff call when 1 minute into this match he just said, "This is a great one." And then there was a pause. And I'm assuming that pause was Mike Tenay just turning and looking at him as if to say, "What?" I mean, the one thing you could say about this match is it was mercifully short, wasn't it?
Yes, very, very short. Hulk did a promo away quick.
What were we saying, like 2 minutes 30 or something?
2:21.
2:21.
2:21. It was beautiful. Even longer than you thought it was.
Like the perfect punk song.
Yes, exactly. The perfect Hulk match is 2 minutes and 21 seconds long.
Yes.
To just give you the outline for those of historians who want to know, obviously, Animal and Hulk, the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors, Kensuke Sasaki and Hulk, the Hell Raisers, Animal and Kensuke Sasaki, the Hell Warriors.
Yes, not the Road Raisers.
No, not the Road Raisers. They didn't go with that one.
No.
No. The theme tune for the Road Warriors is obviously Iron Man. The theme tune for Hell Raisers is Hellraiser by Ozzy Osbourne.
Of course.
And Ozzy Osbourne did a very special mix of Iron Man and Hellraiser together for the Hell Warriors. As a thank you to the Road Warriors for the years of exposing Iron Man to a new audience.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I never really thought about that.
There you go.
I'd imagine there's a good chunk of America that only know that song.
Yeah.
But, also Robert Downey Jr. now as well.
Yes, true. All right then, moving on to the semi-main event, which featured a dream match from, well, a dream rematch. These two teams had a long-running series a couple of years before. Over the IWGP Tag Team Championship, which at the time were considered some of the best tag team wrestling ever in the world. They were the pioneers of, both teams were the pioneers of the power and science style. In the early to mid 80s, you'd have the science revolution in tag team wrestling, the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express, the Hart Foundation, the British Bulldogs, those kind of tag teams. Then in the later 80s, there was the real exposure of the Road Warriors and the Powers of Pain and Demolition, the power tag teams, the Steiners, and Kensuke Sasaki and Hirohashi really mixed power and science equally. It wasn't just about suplexes, but it was also about submission holds. They were really two exciting tag teams. But then you kind of watched All Japan Women a couple of years later, and you had Manami Toyota and Toshiya Yamada, and you had the LCO. They kind of surpassed that as being like the cutting edge of tag team wrestling, which is kind of the basis for the tag team wrestling we see today.
Or at least the junior division, certainly.
Yeah, certainly. You know, so, but again, it was a dream match, and this was actually probably a bit better than some of the matches I'd seen them in together. Certainly we talked about, me and Alex, when we looked at the first Starrcade in the Tokyo Dome, which was the first match those two had together. It had such a legendary reputation, and it didn't really hold up to time, whereas this, I think, was actually a better match because it was better paced.
Yes.
What did you think of this, Si?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, apart from at the end when the cameraman inexplicably decided to miss the pinfall.
Yes.
He was just looking over to the side. Just like, oh, there's some things going on over there. I won't watch what is obviously the finishing move going on in the ring.
Oh,
right,
look
now
at this North Korean mob who sat in the front.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But no, apart from that, it was, and this was also the match when my hair radar started going just mental.
Oh, I mean, there is mullets galore in this,
God,
isn't there?
I mean, Scott Steiner, obviously, like that era of Scott Steiner, that is the pinnacle of mullet for me.
Like yes, that. Yes, like, it's a fine body, of hair.
Sasaki had the almost Tenzan like skullet.
Yes, he did. Yeah,
that he was rocking. And Hase, not a mullet. I mean, I've got in my notes here. I describe it as the Barry the Carpenter.
Right.
So it's the kind of glossy, long but straight with the mustache.
Yeah.
That you expect. It's a bloke called Barry. He's a carpenter by trade. He goes to the pub of a night wearing all denim.
Yeah, with white patent leather shoes.
Well, I was thinking snakeskin boots, but
yeah, interchangeable at this point.
Yeah, obviously. Absolutely. And he sits in the corner of the bar chatting up women that are way too young for him.
With a half shandy.
Could be a half shandy. Yeah. Could be a half shandy. These days it'd have been Alka-Pop.
Yes,
but
true.
Obviously. In the 70s, no yes. such thing.
The period we were thinking of.
Halcyon
maybe
days.
A baby show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Barry loves a Perry.
Yeah.
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 So that's, I always like to just tell you where my headspace is before these, big matches.
Essentially is Lothario-ing in a bar in
yeah,
Swindon.
But just really badly.
Yeah.
But he thinks he's it.
Yeah, that's it.
And he was.
He was,
surprisingly
indeed.
Enough,
and a member of this, another member of the Diet on this card.
Well, we're talking about a peace envoy to North Korea. Of course, they signed them all up.
Yeah, but you look at this match. It was actually like you've got Hiro Hase, who's now had a 20-year career in the Japanese Diet, and is still a member of the Japanese government, I believe. And Rick Steiner is a state senator in his own right.
He's a what?
He's a state senator.
I did not know this.
I'm sure he's either a state congressman or a state senator in Atlanta, in Georgia. I'm sure he is.
That has blown my mind.
Yeah. He might be city councilman, but one of those lower level local politicians. He's definitely elected to an office in the state of Georgia, I believe.
What is wrong with America?
What's wrong with Rick Steiner?
I mean, he probably
not.
Scott, I'm sure
Steiner.
He's, yeah, well, that's. well. I mean. Promo-wise, Scott Steiner is essentially the Donald Trump of wrestling. So, but only one of them is in the WWE Hall of Fame. So
this is true. And the other one will never be in the WWE Hall of Fame.
No, probably not. Which is a shame, because that speech would be amazing.
He's in the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Yes.
The one in the museum. Yes. But I was on a conference call, an Impact conference call, a couple of months ago, and somebody asked him, would you ever go into the WWE Hall of Fame? And he was like, no.
You fat bastard!
Why? And then, yeah, so he explained, so he would never, ever go into the WWE Hall of Fame. You know,
yeah,
so.
I don't think they're going to ask him.
That is the minor point, right? Of like, yeah, the Steiners might go in.
Yeah, but you'd still have to let him do a speech.
Yeah.
And, you know.
As long as you give Rick the microphone, because he's so talkative.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, well, they gave Jim Cornette a live mic, I suppose, didn't they? So
yeah, well, they trusted Jim.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yes, so Steiners versus Hass. We haven't talked much about this wrestling match, but it was all right.
Actually. Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it's a good match. Yeah,
11:51. Tad short. 11:51. I kind of would like to have gone a bit longer.
Yeah, yeah, could have done.
And I believe we did miss, when the cameraman went off camera, we did actually miss a Steiner driver. The lesser spotted Steiner driver, because not many people would take it.
Yeah.
Because it was really ridiculously dangerous. There is a great story when he was feuding with Petey Williams in Impact Wrestling. Petey goes, so how are we going to finish the match tonight? And Scott goes, Steiner driver! And Petey goes, you haven't done that move in 12 years. No. Steiner driver. That's all he would do for the next like 10 minutes. So we move on to the main event, which featured Antonio Inoki wrestling the Nature Boy Ric Flair in an all-time dream match between two wrestling legends that happened in front of a bunch of people who had no idea who they were.
They woke up, though.
They did wake up. And it was, to be honest with you, if you're going to put a show on in front of a bunch of people who have no idea what professional wrestling is, I'd pick these two.
Yes.
Because you have the all-time classic heel versus the all-time classic babyface.
Yes.
It is human drama in pure essence form.
And the perfect spot for Ric Flair at this time in his career, because he's in front of a load of people who've never seen his shtick before.
Exactly.
So he can go through all, and he's got the Flair flops, and he's begging off. And
yeah.
He just... Painting by numbers, Ric Flair match. Absolutely perfect for the situation. Didn't have to think about it. No. He just put that match on, the match that he's done 100 million times, and they lapped it up.
Yeah, and it was fine. It did exactly what it said. And it was pretty much a standard Inoki match as well. They just jigsawed it together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know. It's a rare occurrence that a wrestling dream match actually lives up to what you expect it was going to be. especially considering the all-time classic Inoki dream match, of course, with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
That one, not so much of a classic.
No. Who was there?
Yes, he was.
He was at this particular event.
Part of the press junket.
Yeah, he was. It was. Yeah, there was some other wrestling politics we actually forgot to mention. If we go back to the Steiner brothers versus Hiroshi Hase and Kensuke Sasaki. We talked about Benoit and Too Cold Scorpio being ECW wrestlers. The Steiner brothers were under contract to WWF at the time.
Really?
Yes, they were unique. There's only two tag teams who have had outside deals in WWE history. The others was British Bulldogs, because they negotiated their deal whilst they were still in All Japan Wrestling. And they were on such good money with Baba, they didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
So they did 2 weeks on for WWF, and then they did 2 weeks for All Japan. And that was the schedule they ran for about 2 years, until the run-up to WrestleMania 2, where they had where Pat Patterson said, "We're going to give you the title shot at WrestleMania 2. And Dynamite said, "What about the championships at WrestleMania 2? And Pat went, "I'll talk to Vince." And then he came back and he went, "As long as you don't go back to Japan again, you can have the belts." I'm like, "All right then."
Mistake.
Well, yeah, but they had, that was their most famous run, and they,
I guess. Certainly for Davey it worked out. Yeah, I'm just not sure it did so much for Dynamite.
No. But that wasn't, that was more Ray Rougeau's fault than Dynamite's fault.
Yeah, all right.
So, you know, it wasn't really anything to do with Vince. It's just that Dynamite didn't want anything to do with Vince after that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were on good money in All Japan, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in politics which we shouldn't really go into, because we'd be there all night. But the Steiners also had the same deal, because they were earning, I believe they were on $10,000 a night with New Japan Pro Wrestling. That was the rumor.
Jeez.
Yeah, not $10,000 a tour, $10,000 each a night. So
I think you're right. It should have gone longer than 11 minutes.
Plus expenses. They were working for WWF, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why they only had one tag team championship reign, and they never really clicked with Vince, because they weren't really Vince's style of wrestlers, and they weren't that. You're just not in the right place at the right time. There was also the point that in WWF at the time, no one would wrestle them. No one liked wrestling them. The only person who did was Bo Beverly, Mike Enos, who'd wrestled them a ton in Japan anyway, and was like, got on with them really well. And was had no, yes, Frankensteiner, no problem. But if you actually watch the TV matches, even the job guys wouldn't work with him.
Well, again, Foley was one of the ones that used to dread getting his name put up next to the Steiners, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. So, you know, if the big names weren't keen, the job guys just flatly refused. Mike Enos wrestled in a bunch of matches in a mask just so that someone could take a Frankensteiner.
Yeah.
You know. Which is ridiculous, because Mike trusted Scott to do it properly.
It's a hell of a way to earn a paycheck, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Wrestle three times against Scott Steiner every night. And see if your vertebrae are still in the same place in the morning.
Yeah.
You might have to pick them up off the floor. And that kind of wraps this card up. There is a bunch of other political stuff we can talk about in this show. Let's go match by match. So we talked about ECW. Obviously, Nagata ends up being one of New Japan's all-time biggest draws, and it's nice to see him in his early mode, and you realize he hasn't really changed that much. He's just refined that act an awful lot.
Yeah.
Obviously, Chono is the start of his full-on heel mode, so it's worth watching for that. Of course, the All Japan women are the best thing on the show by a long, long way. This was the night Akira Hokuto met Kensuke Sasaki, and they were married within a year.
Oh.
Which is a true story. Still married to this day. They have a son. I think she has a son from a previous marriage, and they have an adoptive son who's in the I think he's in the Noah Dojo. It might have made his debut by now. Mm. But he was working with his dad, or his adopted dad, in Diamond Rings, which was Kensuke Sasaki's NXT style set him up promotion. Hashimoto, obviously no longer with us, sadly, but Scott Norton still makes odd appearances for New Japan Pro Wrestling.
He does.
And does wrestle for other companies in Japan as a veteran. And did go on to eventually win the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Was probably the most successful gaijin in New Japan up until Kenny Omega, I would guess.
Is he in the Bullet Club?
No, he's not. He was in. He isn't in Bullet Club, because they had a reunion with Masa Saito. He came back as well, didn't they? It was Team 2000 reunion.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in it with Team 2000 now consists of Tenzan, Kojima, Saito, and Scott Norton, and Cheeseburger.
Yeah. Yeah. It should really have...
And Liger, yeah.
It should really have...
Because Liger was in Team 2000.
It should have Bo Dallas and Bray Wyatt in, really, shouldn't it?
Yeah, they should do. Right. Yes, indeed.
Mick and Johnny Wall Street.
Yes. Road Warrior Hawk obviously stayed in WCW and New Japan for a little while after that, and then they got a big money offer from WWE and went for their second money mega run. Steiner Brothers didn't last much longer in WWF. They came back home with their tail between the legs to WCW to feud with the Road Warriors,
yes,
and the Nasty Boys and Public Enemy and a bunch of other tag teams. They all managed to get together in the same place at the same time for about 3 months. Back in WCW's Wild West days, when they would hire anyone for a 3 month period,
yeah,
they had the biggest names in tag team wrestling history. And I think they managed to get two Nitros and a pay-per-view out of it.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Literally, they're Public Enemy, Harlem Heat, the Steiners, the Road Warriors. I think they had the Nasty Boys back as well. So that's like six of the best tag teams of that particular era,
yeah,
all on the same company, and they did nothing with it.
No.
Well, what can you do? It's usual. And then Antonio Inoki, as you know, went on to run New Japan Pro Wrestling into the ground over the next decade, but we'll talk about that as we get to it in the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling.
Yeah, all that to look forward to.
And North Korea is still there. And this week they start negotiations with South Korea about ending this year war, which hopefully, I hope they do, because, you know, you can't be mad at each other for that long. It's pretty serious, really.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd like not for nuclear bombs to be dropped on us.
That would be lovely.
That would be really nice.
And if that doesn't happen, then I think we can all say that it was Ric Flair that originally started this process.
No, we can't blame Ric, because he had a good match. We've got to blame
I mean, if nuclear bombs don't drop.
Oh, okay. I see. I see what you mean now.
If nuclear bombs do drop, I'm blaming Scott Steiner.
Oh, fair enough then. That's reasonable. But being serious for a second, what are your thoughts on the business side of this match, and what are your thoughts on like the whole card as an experience?
I'm not gonna lie. Watching this was a slog. Now I don't know whether it was the relatively ropey copy,
yeah,
the utterly indifferent commentary, or whether it was just because I had no context around it. There was little bits here and there that I really enjoyed.
Yeah,
the women's match, couple of bit. I don't think I could. I think that was the only whole match that I enjoyed. Possibly, yeah, the main event.
Hmm.
But there was bits of the other ones that I really enjoyed. But overall, yeah, bit of a slog. But it's a fascinating sort of historical artifact, I think, is, yes, probably the best way of describing it. It's,
yeah,
it's, you know, it's not going to blow your mind, but it's worth watching just for...
How did they get all these people from, yeah, four different companies that... to this place where capitalism just doesn't exist?
Yeah.
Because pro wrestling is the most capitalistic thing outside of... the money pits in Wall Street and the final of the World Series of Poker. I cannot think of anything that is more money based than pro wrestling.
Yeah.
You know, and they went to a country which effectively money doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, and it is like, how did this all work? And are we giving Antonio Inoki too much credit? Obviously there was a lot of help, but it just seems so.
Well, I know we linked it to the Saudi Arabia trip,
yeah,
this week, but it's not really the same thing, because we all know why the WWE went to Saudi Arabia.
Money.
Yeah.
Huge
bags of money.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you say what you want about it, that's definitely the reason.
Yeah.
But you can't necessarily say that about this card.
No, because they had no money.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they got paid,
because, yeah,
Bischoff wouldn't be sniffing around it if there wasn't a sack of cash somewhere. But... it's weird. It sort of almost feels like they're doing it for influence rather than cash.
Yeah.
I wonder if their hope was that maybe they could break through and do this on a regular basis.
I'm thinking probably along the same lines, because Inoki goes back to South Korea on a fairly regular basis, and he kind of like started New Japan's encroachment into Singapore and other places as, yeah, well. Certainly New Japan's a much more international effort than it was then, but the technology's there now to support it. You don't have, yeah, to have a TV show. You don't have to have all the things you used to be able to have run a TV.
And it's only been in the last few years, really.
Yeah, yeah.
They've been properly attempting to move to a global audience.
I mean, if you look at we're going to Pro Wrestling Eve tomorrow, but just using that company as an example, they were the first British company to live stream an iPay-per-view in 2013. Now every company in the country does that.
Except Progress.
Yeah. Well, not majority of them. That's not to say everyone, but they all have that option available to them. Whereas, like, you know, that short period of time, you could run a country like North Korea, and people do. I mean, there's all those old international tours and the old international circuit where, like, Sanjay Dutt goes, hires a ring somewhere in Delhi and puts a show on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, that's not the same as, like, trying to have a concerted effort to break an entire major company into a market. And that's really, I'm not sure they were trying to do that, but
the nearest thing that I could think of to this is the Pavarotti shows in that's what I kind of imagine those were. I mean, obviously I've never seen footage from one of them. I don't know whether it even exists, but
I've seen footage of Pavarotti playing a saxophone on his way to the ring.
It's on the back of a flatbed truck.
I used to talk to Pavarotti on Twitter before his unfortunate legal wranglings of murder.
Yes.
I would not talk to him now. It seems his Twitter account seems to have disappeared, funnily enough.
Yeah, it's weird that, isn't it?
Yeah. But, as he's in prison for murder. Mm. But it's that kind of thing. It is like wrestling in front of an audience that just doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, there's some big show. I think the first time WWE run India, Kevin Nash was saying, is like, you know, you go to this place and it's a 50,000 seater and there's 75,000 people in it.
Yeah.
And no one knows what the hell's going on. It's the worst wrestling show you've ever seen because everyone's got their spots and no one has any reactions for the spots because they have no idea what it means.
Yeah. So the wrestlers don't know where to go.
Yeah.
Because nothing's working. So you can't like, oh, I'm going to change it up and try this. Oh, no, that's not working either.
Yeah. So it is really hard for them to put matches into that context.
But the main event was interesting because the crowd did start to get up for that, and Antonio Inoki was really like pushing the kind of Butlin's camp kind of shallows, like turning to the crowd and you know, really sort of big gestures and wide eyes, and that was sort of really interesting to me because you wouldn't necessarily see that in a match of that kind of scale, generally speaking.
No.
But this complete neophyte audience, you almost have to get back to that. It's almost like wrestling in front of a load of 8-year-olds, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially.
You have to go back
to
that classic, you know, what works.
I think one of the reasons why Daniel Bryan is so popular is because there's a lot of that in his act, you know, because that's where he learnt his chops. That's where he got good.
Yeah.
He's working with Robbie Brookside on Seaside shows. And
well, I mean, look at the entire NXT training staff.
they all worked on wrestling booths and they learned how to shoot and hooks and no one brought their arm and they could work tomorrow and then they went on the back camps and did shows from here on to God's End.
Last three rounds with the Gladiator and win a fiver.
Yeah. You might pay for the soup you're going to need to buy because you're brocking your teeth.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, so it is interesting. It is an interesting philosophical artifact. It is interesting as like a nuts and bolts ABC wrestling show. How do you impress a crowd that don't know what they're doing?
Yeah.
And certainly, I don't think it's going to be great shakes as a diplomatic document, but look at the guys who went.
Yeah.
And you look at the state of wrestling at the time. It's the one show in wrestling history where you actually get a good idea of what wrestling was like around the world, because you've got so many people from so many different companies. You've got people representing ECW, representing WWE, representing New Japan Pro Wrestling. You've got people there who've done some time in Mexico recently.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is what pro wrestling was like in 1994. It's the biggest show of all time just because the amount of people have gone to see it. You know, over 300,000 people in 2 days, or around 300,000 people were the announced numbers.
Yeah.
And that's just a feat in itself, just to get that amount of people into a building. You're right, they were told to go, but you know, also the amount of money they spent on the production values for it, because it was like the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look like they'd just, you know, emptied a barn out, did it? Like,
no,
it was a proper event.
Yeah, they did like this gymnastics, there's rhythmic gymnastics, there's there's parallel bars and there's all sorts of stuff going on.
The timekeeper was dressed like he was in a high school marching band.
To be fair, he just wore that normally. That was his everyday. That's what New Japan...
I just wanted to bring it up because I thought it was great.
there was one New Japan announcer suit and they all wore that one.
It's like the mascot outfit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, oh, Phil, did you not clean this out?
Did you notice he had to ring the timekeeper's bell as well?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah, he skittered off after the introductions, yeah, didn't he?
Did double duty. Yeah. But that pretty much wraps up our coverage for the
Collision of Peace.
There you go. The Pyongyang International Sports and Culture Festival for Peace.
Yes.
Or Collision in Korea, as Eric Bischoff very wisely called it.
Yeah. Collision for Peace of Korea.
Yes, anyway. Collision for Peace.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening to The Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This was my show. I'd like to thank my guest today, Mr. Simon Heath. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. You can find him at Butlin's Club on Twitter. Are you still turning away followers? Or?
I mean, it's quality over quantity. That's all I'll say about my Twitter. Like,
so if you're really cool, follow Si.
Maybe one tweet. No, I don't mean followers. I mean my tweets.
Right.
I tweet once every 5 days, but it's usually a blinder.
But again, if you're really good, follow Si. You can find the show at Troopany Show. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter. You can find all of our regular contributors on Twitter. They're all in our follow list. If you can find them from there.
Or the internet.
The internet. Okay. Also, thank you for listening to us. And please, please pledge on our Patreon. You can find that at Patreon Troopany Show. And we're also on Facebook as well now, as well, where we make big announcements and things like that for those of the followers there. Thank you very much for your time. Next week, we will be at Wrestling Dontaku when we've all watched everything.
Yeah. When we've stopped going to live wrestling and watched some wrestling that's not live.
And the week after that, hopefully, we'll be at Wrestle Queendom. We'll be reviewing that because Chelsea would like to review it with us.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
So we'll be looking at the Pro Wrestling Eve live stream and how that works.
Probably forgotten about it by then, but we'll try.
And that's pretty much been it for the Troopany Show for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy your bank holiday Monday. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.